This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's a report on the changing retail landscape. Kohl's district manager Kristen Lee says Bloomington's Eastland Mall needs to stay current.
You have to create a different experience. So the layout of the current mall is awful. It's awful.
GLT's Ryan Denham reports on the direction of retail sales with smaller stores and shorter shopping experiences. Plus, John Norton reports on a band that's a cross between Van Morrison and Johnny Cash. It's Matt Garrison and the Robber Barons. A new exhibit and a leadership structure change at the Children's Discovery Museum in Uptown Normal. And the Democratic candidate for governor gives his stump speech. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Weeks after another anchor store closure at Eastland Mall, Bloomington Normal business leaders are grappling with the future of retail. The changing retail landscape was the focus of the McLean County Chamber of Commerce's recent BN the Know event. GLT's Ryan Denham was there and finds the challenges facing retailers are much more complex than just Amazon versus brick and mortar.
Paul Sherman's voice will sound familiar to you. He's the owner of Sherman's, the appliance, electronics, furniture, and mattress retailer. The commercials are very memorable. He's got about 170 employees in four locations. When you ask him to predict the future of retail, he's quick to reflect on the recent past.
My understanding and thoughts on where our company needs to be from a promotional versus branding perspective and traditional media versus digital has changed dramatically since April. How we structure some other things internally changed dramatically from last December. How we staffed our floors and things we need to do, totally different thoughts, and have learned many things since last May. It's like if you asked me 18 months ago where we would be today, I would not have been able to predict where we are.
Retailers like Sherman say the pace of change is relentless, and it's not just online shopping that's doing it. Retailers also have to meet changing customer expectations for the in-store experience, things like phone-based payment like Apple Pay. And it's not just the customers that have changed. Retailers say their workforce is changing too, and the low local unemployment has led to a hiring shortage for some stores. But the threat and opportunities of online shopping were the elephant in the room at the Chamber's Be in the Know event last month at Eastland Suites, where Paul Sherman was one of three panelists. Another one was Kohl's district manager Kristen Lee. Kohl's is the lone remaining anchor store at Eastland Mall. Lee says there's lots of different customers to think about. They've got the brick and mortar shopper, the ship from store customer, and the buy online, pick up in store customer.
And then we have a new customer, the buy online, ship to store. So that's going to be a newer customer for us where they shop at home. They don't want it delivered to their house because maybe they're in a neighborhood that's not quite safe, and they don't really want to pay the shipping cost of that, so they're just going to ship it to our store. So then we have that customer coming in. So, you know, from a local district manager perspective, my associates have four different customers now that they're trying to help.
Sherman says yes, customers are shopping online. So those customers who do make it into his stores are more informed and more serious than they were in the past. And the shift is still clear. The mattress industry went from 95% brick and mortar to just 75% today.
You know, 10-15% of the appliance business is transacted online, and we're at about 2%. You know, if that doesn't bother you as a business owner, it should. One of our major initiatives is having a better online presence so we can catch up with that. As that number goes up, if we don't improve our presence in that space, our ease of checkout, our information we provide, that business is certainly going to go somewhere else.
Kristen Lee from Kohl's says Amazon isn't always an adversary. Her company recently brought one of its newest experiments to the store in Peru, about an hour north of Bloomington Normal.
We have an Amazon return center. So if you purchase something on Amazon and you don't like it, you did not get it at Kohl's, obviously, you just bring it to the Kohl's store. You don't have to package it. We'll package it for you, and we ship it to Amazon. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, Amazon's a pretty big competitor. If you can't beat them, join them. Don't go to the local Kohl's here and try to return Amazon yet, please. But it's coming. We just launched it in Milwaukee. It's happening in Chicago. We're just trying to test to see what additional traffic that will bring. We want to see, from a customer standpoint, those who are shopping at Amazon online, if we make it convenient for you to return it to our store, it'll force you to come into our store. And a lot of our stores have the service desk way in the back. I know you don't like that, but way in the back, you got to walk through now the whole store and say, ooh, I didn't know Kohl's carried that. I didn't know that. Hopefully you'll walk out buying something.
Hy-Vee's 2015 opening in Bloomington was met with great fanfare, but even Hy-Vee faces competitive challenges that require evolving. That's according to marketing and merchandising director Sarah Hulk. Take grocery delivery, a growing business that's being offered by more and more stores, not to mention third parties like Instacart.
I think fast and free delivery is very important, and you absolutely need to offer it to, you know, be competitive and be in the game and all of that. But that's kind of what everyone is doing right now and what everyone is striving for. So while both of those are very important, and I think it, everyone should be, you know, be in that, I also think that you can do more to stay competitive. And again, with us, the little bit extra could be if you order groceries, we'll bring it in, put it in your counter, or put it in your freezer, or whatever the customer wants, really. But I think in order to stay competitive, it needs to be a little bit more than that, and that can be different based on what your product is and who your audience is.
Kristen Lee says she started with Kohl's as a part-time associate while going to college. She says all those anchor stores that have been closing around Kohl's, from Bergner's to Sears to JCPenney, it's sad, even if Kohl's is doing fine. Kohl's is watching like the rest of us to see what happens at Eastland Mall. Owner CBL is redeveloping a few spaces there for new purposes. The JCPenney is becoming an H&M store and a Planet Fitness. A new Outback is being built in the parking lot. Here's Kristen Lee.
But a couple of things I think, you know, the mall is have to do different is you have to create a different experience. So the layout of the current mall is awful. It's awful. You have a food court that's non-existent, but look at the location of that food court. From a convenience standpoint, if you're going to go into a mall and shop, you have a mission. You're on a mission. We no longer have time to leisurely shop and let's go to the mall and I'm going to spend my money. We don't have time for that. So we got to be able to come in and come out and, oh, if I want to come in and eat something, I just want it to be right over here. I don't want to have to walk down four corridors, turn right, and then find the food court. So it's the convenience and the layout of malls that I think is hindering some of that.
Lee says that Kohl's is moving towards smaller stores that requires less inventory and fewer employees. And Kohl's is finding they're more profitable, too. The typical Kohl's, like the one in Bloomington, is about 80,000 square feet. Kohl's is experimenting with stores as small as 35,000 square feet. That evolution isn't confined to the mall. Sarah Hulk says Hy-Vee opened a new concept store in downtown Des Moines, Iowa last year. It's about 35,000 square feet, half the size of the Hy-Vee in Bloomington.
It's like the neighborhood type place that offers a lot of local, and it's something that you can walk to, and it's just right down the street. And so we are starting to do some things like that. We also just opened a standalone health market in Des Moines that is also kind of like a neighborhood setting type thing. It's supposed to be fast and fresh. You can stop in and get something healthy for lunch on your lunch break, that kind of thing. So obviously doesn't pertain to us in a lot of our markets, but we are starting to do some of that in Des Moines. A lot of our new stores are going in big metro, so it's kind of a diverse area, but we are starting to focus somewhat on that.
But even if you have a smaller store or if you go to a cashless checkout, you're still going to need some employees. Kristen Lee with Kohl's says finding, training, and retaining employees isn't easy these days.
Hiring is really going to be one of the biggest challenges. Increasing minimum wages and, you know, just competitors, you know, from a retail big box standpoint, we're always looking at what's Target doing. You know, what are they doing? How much are they paying? And there's definitely a wage gap. And it's going to stretch a lot of retailers' dollars quite thin in the next 10 years, depending on how high we get. I know here locally we have a big hiring shortage, which is surprising with the amount of retailers closing, but it's really throughout my district and really countrywide. I think low unemployment is good, but from a retail perspective, it's hard. It's really hard to get that talent into our stores.
This Be in the Know retail discussion was moderated by the Chamber's Government and Public Affairs Manager, John Walsh. I'm Ryan Denham.
Be in the Know sessions take place quarterly throughout the year. GLT is a co-sponsor of the series.
Support for GLT comes from Bloomington Parks Recreation and Cultural Arts, announcing registration is now open for their fall season of sports, education, and art programs for youth and adults. You can register for all programs plus special events at bloomingtonparks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Children's Discovery Museum rolls out a new exhibit. Incumbent Bruce Rauner has yet to come face-to-face with his Democratic challenger J.B. Pritzker in their race for governor, but they came close during a recent stop in Normal. Both men appeared separately but back-to-back at the Illinois Agricultural Legislative Roundtable's candidate forum at Raider Farms recently. As part of GLT election coverage, we're bringing you stump speeches of some of the top-of-the-ticket candidates. Pritzker used his speech to criticize Rauner's first term. He told the tent full of farmers that Rauner has tried to cut agriculture education funding and hasn't done enough to lobby for farmers in Washington.
Now, I'm not going to pretend to be a farmer, but I am a businessman like most of you. And because I'm in business here in Illinois, and I've been creating sustainable packaging and manufacturer of sustainable packaging, and I rent wooden pallets. That sounds a little boring to some of you, but it's a great business here in Illinois. So I've created jobs and grown those businesses. And I know we need to make it easier for businesses here in our state to grow jobs and expand our economy. I understand how vital the agriculture industry is if we want our economy to succeed. Corn, soybeans, hogs, cattle, dairy, the diversity of our ag industry is truly awesome. And with $19 or $20 billion of revenue so critical to the economy of the state of Illinois, nearly a million people employed, that I know how important it is to our future. There's enormous opportunity for growth in the industries that all of you represent within ag if we make the right decisions going forward. That's why agriculture should never be a partisan issue, not here in our state. This is about jobs and economic opportunity. It shouldn't be about rural versus urban or Democrats versus Republicans. And frankly, I remember a day when Democrats and Republicans worked together in this state to get important things done. Again, this is a nonpartisan set of issues, if you ask me. Growing the agricultural economy critical to our state. As farmers and business people, you should expect the government will be a stable partner for you in helping to grow the economy, educating and training a quality workforce, and investing in infrastructure. Again, the government should be your partner in this endeavor, but Bruce Rauner has failed at all of those things, all of them. His failure to work together to achieve a budget for three straight years and his desire to put his personal political agenda first led to economic uncertainty and the biggest budget deficits in the history of the state of Illinois. Let me repeat that. His intransigence, his unwillingness to compromise, led to the biggest budget deficits in the history of the state of Illinois. 4 years ago, Governor Rauner stood before you at this forum, and he made a whole bunch of promises. He said that he would lower property taxes. He said that he would invest heavily in education. He said that he would invest in technology in our schools. He said that he would bring vocational training back to our high schools. He hasn't delivered. Then, shortly after he was sworn in, Bruce Rauner began dismantling the state's commitment to our agriculture industry. In his first 3 years in office, Rauner's budget proposals severely reduced or zeroed out a bunch of programs. Funding across the board. For example, agriculture education and vocational education, which keeps the next generation here in our communities, in the communities in which they've grown up. 4-H, which reaches 200,000 kids in all 102 counties of this state. County fairs, which are an economic engine and bring more than $170 million of revenue and economic activity. Soil and water conservation districts, which help ensure a healthy future for farming by preventing soil erosion and by controlling floodwaters. So for 3 years, Bruce Rauner caused vital agriculture programs to be diminished. Now it's 2018. What's he doing in 2018? He's running for re-election. And he's bragging that all of these programs are funded for the first time in 4 years. For him, this is all just a political stunt, not the product of a real effort to stand up for our ag industry. Bruce Rauner's been a complete failure for the state. Serious damage was done during the last 3.5 years. Higher education institutions and agricultural programs were decimated under Bruce Rauner's budget crisis. That's caused tremendous damage to SIUE, SIUC, ACES, and at Western. 72,000 fewer students are attending Illinois colleges after students were left uncertain about whether they'll be able to get their MAP grants. And Rauner proposed a 30% cut in higher education, and people are waiting to see if that's his next proposal. Because he put it out before, it didn't go through, could be the next thing. We can't afford that in this state. Rauner's created fewer jobs in Illinois in 3.5 years than Pat Quinn did in the same time period. Fewer jobs than Pat Quinn in the same time period. To balance the budget this year, he actually proposed forcing local governments to raise local property taxes. Now, I think you just heard him probably say that he wants a property tax freeze. Those things don't go together. When you push down $1 billion of tax increases on local governments and then say you want a property tax freeze, that doesn't work. The math doesn't work. And cuts in the state's Department of Agriculture forced the closure of the Galesburg Animal Disease Laboratory, a huge loss for our livestock industry in this state. That lab was our state's frontline response when we ran into challenges like in 2014-2015 with the bird flu epidemic, when we lost millions of chickens and turkeys all across the Midwest. Uncertainty kills business and wreaks havoc. Uncertainty. That's why our recent trade war is so damaging. Stability in world trade is what you're looking for. Politicians in Washington, D.C. should be fighting for our ag industry. You want a governor who recognizes that sometimes you need to stand up and be heard, even in Washington, D.C., even in Congress. You want a governor who will do that. In 3.5 years, Governor Rauner hasn't once called our senior most senator. Not once. He's not called him once to ask for anything from the federal government for our state. Think about that. By virtue of his inaction, the governor thinks that the current trade policies are just fine right now. Inaction. Because that's what it's been all about for him, inaction. I think he's wrong. I'm going to stand up and fight back against the tariffs that are hurting farmers. The problem is that you're losing longstanding customers. I understand the challenge of losing a customer. Once gone, it's extremely hard to win a customer back. I'm in the business of making sustainable packaging, and when we lose a customer, it's hugely damaging. We make sustainable packaging for McDonald's. And if our price increases 1 year and McDonald's decides to find another supplier, it's really tough to get that customer back from McDonald's. We want McDonald's to be a customer of ours, and if they choose somebody else 1 year, they may not switch back. And that's the same thing that can happen under this trade war. Similarly, Chinese tariffs on Illinois soybeans could cost our soybean farmers $420 million this year. If we lose a customer like China to Brazil or to Argentina, just like if I lose McDonald's, they may be gone forever, and we just can't afford that. The same thing is true in the pork industry. Pork production supports about 10,000 jobs in our state, and Illinois exports about 25% of its pork production. Mexico's a top market, China number two. Last week, I toured the JBS pork plant in Beardstown with over 2,200 employees, and it's growing. It's the largest employer in Cass County. A huge amount of production goes to Mexico and China, and if the tariff issue isn't resolved, it will have an enormous impact on the employees and on the local economy in Beardstown and throughout Cass County. Pork producers have just begun to feel the impact of these tariffs. A full-blown trade war would be a disaster, truly a disaster. As a substitute for doing business, $12 billion in federal farming subsidies is like putting a Band-Aid on a heart attack. Not good enough. You need a governor who will work every single day to create jobs and to build up our ag industry. I'll be your best advocate and cheerleader. I'll help expand markets abroad by leading agriculture trade missions so that you can grow your customer base. At home, support for the agriculture industry starts by maintaining the sales tax exemption for farmers and continuing to support the farmland assessment law. Unlike Bruce Rauner, I think that funding ag education is an investment in our future. And promoting ag tech startup companies at our universities is another angle on building up our ag industry. But we can't grow the industry unless we improve infrastructure in this state. Now, once again, Bruce Rauner promised 4 years ago that he was going to invest in infrastructure. Didn't do it. Roads and port districts are how you get your products from farm to market. But we haven't had a major capital bill since 2009. Our roads get a D rating from the American Society of Civil Engineers, a D rating. River traffic and flood control on the Illinois River is managed by 8 locks and dams, which farmers rely on to get crops to market. These assets are badly outdated, with aging infrastructure and a backlog of deferred maintenance. So that's why it's critically important that you have a governor who talks to our federal officials, who's actually talking to the people who represent us in Washington, D.C., and not one who's utterly silent. There's so much to do to lift up our ag industry in Illinois. So it's important that when policy is being made about one of our state's most important industries, we need farmers from across Illinois to be sitting at the table. I intend to appoint individuals who speak the language of agriculture and will help us grow your industry. Illinois needs a governor who understands that the future of farming is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. Our economy was built on agriculture. This industry is indispensable to communities and to the business of our state. If we want economic growth, if we want job growth, we have got to make sure we're investing in the growth of the ag industry. Your future is Illinois' future. It's time to come together to solve the state's problems. The status quo just isn't going to cut it anymore. The solutions are not blue or red. They're not liberal or conservative. They're not Democratic or Republican. They're just common sense. We know that the promise of Illinois outweighs the problems of Illinois. We have big challenges ahead. There's no doubt about it. And I've demonstrated the ability to work together to get big things done for Illinois throughout my history. You heard some of it during the introduction. But I really believe that our best days are ahead of us. And that if we work together to problem solve, not hyper-partisanship, but truly problem solve to grow our state's economy, we can do it. I look forward to taking your questions and hearing from you. Thank you very much.
That's Democratic candidate for governor J.B. Pritzker speaking recently at an agricultural candidates forum in Bloomington Normal. You'll hear Attorney General candidate Kwame Raoul's stump speech for the Illinois Agricultural Legislative Roundtable tomorrow on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable and timely financial management with a contemporary independent perspective. Zimmerman and Armstrong have been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy talk about saving trees. The Children's Discovery Museum is getting ready to install its first new exhibit in 4 years. The popular Uptown Normal attraction was able to move forward on the project after a long-delayed state grant was finally released. Museum Executive Director Beth Wisman tells GLT's Ryan Dunham the new Imagine Air exhibit is scheduled on Black Friday in November. She says kids will learn about the power of wind.
It's this force, this thing that's happening in nature that you can't see, but you can see the outcome of its work and what's going on. It also has things like wind turbines in our community that might have a child asking, what is that? Why is it here? How does it work? Is it making wind? Is it a big fan on the prairie? We've had that question. No, it's not. Let's tell you how how it works. So Imaginaire is an exhibit that is going to take the kid of any age, really. I think adults will enjoy this as well, and we'll be learning about wind energy, aerodynamics, fluid dynamics, the things that wind create for us, including some challenges, and help them understand the world around them. That's what a children's museum is all about.
Well, for families who are familiar with being on the second floor of the museum and they know what's already in that space there, can you talk about how it'll be different, how it'll look different, and physically what it'll be like?
It'll be bigger, which is always nice, right? We actually are really proud of the space that we have there right now, but the air maze, for instance, that's very popular, predates the building, so it's over almost 15 years old.
And the air maze is this like really intricate series of tubes where you can put stuff in and it flies around a little maze, as
mm-hmm.
you put it.
You know, can change direction. You can use different objects. It's really good about hand-eye coordination, understanding color. And there's all kinds of elements to it, but it's essentially what you just described. It's a tubing that has air shooting through it, and it helps move objects around. That is going to literally turn on its head. So right now there's a bit of an L-shaped wall. So you have two walls of the air maze. We're going to turn that around so you have one wall on the ground and then one over your head. So it's a new design. They're able to do that now, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It also opens up what you're doing with the air and how it's coming down rather than shooting across or up, and that'll give us a whole new direction to work in. It also opens up space, so there's not that wall there that blocks us from expanding into what we currently have, which is our energy challenge. We'll be connecting into that space a little bit better, and that gives us room to add a wind turbine building station, so kids will get a chance to design their own wind turbine and figure out what makes things work, what's efficient, and then take them to a test station and try them out, see if they work. And if they don't, start back again and redesign and learn about, you know, that method. And that really expands that exhibit space. But we're adding something called sink or float, which is going to be, especially for our younger visitors, really kind of cool. They can take a tube and run it across the bottom of these big cylinders and see what different masses and shapes act like when wind and air interacts with them. Will it sink? Will it float? Will it just sit there? Will it fly around? Will it scatter? So it'll give them a chance to do that. And we'll have something called our force wall, where you can use an air cannon to shoot air at the wall. And it will have all kinds of things on it that are moving. There'll be musical instruments, things that we could probably change throughout the year so it's seasonal. And then kids can experiment with what air does to different shapes and different materials, and just have some fun.
Well, how are you paying for this?
We got lucky. The grant that had been awarded to us 4 years ago had been placed on hold indefinitely. And during this budget session, this election year, we heard the governor and the General Assembly had decided to put the funds back in. So $116,800 from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources Capital Program for Museums went to this exhibit. The new cost, because of course 4 years adds construction cost, right, is really more like $127,000, somewhere in that ballpark, $127,500. So we have some money from EDP Renewables, and then the foundation has money it's been raising throughout the years that will help cover that extra cost. But we would like to see if the other wind energy companies in the community are interested in being sponsors and helping support it. So that's not over yet.
Well, when is the last time that you had a new permanent exhibit like this put into the museum?
Well, our last exhibit was the Hello from Japan, which was over 2 years ago. But it's been about 4 years since we actually installed My Great Backyard, which is the youngest of our exhibits on the first floor. When you walk in, you can go into a space that's designed for kids 5 and under. It was very important for the early childhood programs to have something like that. And it's been great. But it's been 4 years. So if you think about the cycle of your child and how they're learning and, you know, what you want to see as they're moving through the museum, as you go up the stairs to the three different floors, you do see a little bit more sophisticated, more complex issues and activities on each floor. We also have stuff for younger kids on every floor, but this would fit into that trend. So 4 years, and hopefully maybe 2 years for the next one.
And last time you were here, you were talking about your interest in the need to overhaul that first floor medical exhibits that folks may be familiar mm-hmm. with. It's fairly old, needs a makeover. What kind of progress have you made on that, and where's that going?
We are talking with some potential donors in our community who are interested in seeing this happen, which is really exciting. We have some volunteers who've stepped forward to lead that effort. So at this point, we can't really talk about any details because nothing is committed. But we feel positive that we will see progress in the next year working towards that goal. I would love to have something to announce by next spring or next summer. But, you know, you don't know. We're fundraising. So sometimes the donors themselves are the ones who are helping guide that timeline.
My understanding is there are a few new programs that have been launched or soon will be to make the museum more accessible to lower-income families or at least those who don't necessarily want to buy a full museum pass. So what are those all about?
Well, we just recently added our checkout. You can check out a family pass from Normal Public Library, but we recently added it to Bloomington. So now those are available. There's a wait list, understandably. So if you want immediate access, a membership is definitely the best way to go. But the other thing that we're starting is part of a national movement through IMLS. It's a federal program to help fund museums and libraries. And it's called Museums for All. And they're encouraging all museums to offer some type of reduced admission for people who are on nutritional assistance. So if you're on a link card, if you participate with WIC, then you can come into the museum and you can register for essentially it's a free card that we'll give you for the year. And then you can use that card for a $3 admission for you and up to 6 guests. We don't really care who you're bringing, if it's the neighbor kids or your cousins or whatever. We just want to make sure kids who don't have access get access. But for $3, that's a good deal. Right now, the admission is $7. I hope that we're reaching new audiences.
Beth Wissman is the Cultural Arts Director for the Town of Normal. She spoke with Ryan Denham. The museum's foundation raises money for exhibits like Imaginaire. It's currently raffling off a breakfast on the balcony package for the ISU Homecoming Parade. Find details at childrensdiscoverymuseum.net. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, John Norton talks with a musician who sings about small-town life and the pressures it brings. How to save a tree and choosing a replacement tree are the two listener questions ISU's Patrick Murphy and GLT's Mike McCurdy try to answer in this edition of our gardening podcast, Grow.
Solving gardening problems is one of the things we really like to do on Grow, and this time it's two problems in one edition of Grow. Patrick Murphy is from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, and I'm GLT's Mike McCurdy. Grow is your source for practical gardening advice, and I hope we can dispense some of that today as it concerns a tree that has a problem and a homeowner facing a problem trying to choose the right tree. Murph, how are you?
I'm well, Mike. How are you?
Good. Let's start with Grant Rucker in Normal, who sounds like he's trying to do all of the right things.
We're in a fairly new part of a subdivision in North Normal, and so we've continued to plant trees over the years to try to, you know, fill it out. And so this was a bald and burlap tree that we put in, had installed last December, right before it got cold.
He sent pictures, which you'll be able to see when this podcast is posted, and this tree does not look good. What kind of tree is it, and what's going on with this thing?
The tree that is in the picture is a type of thornless honey locust. It's a native honey locust.
Native to Illinois.
Native to
Central Illinois.
To North America and Central Illinois. And it is a tree that is... It has been overplanted in a lot of regards. When the tree became popular in the late 70s and early 80s, landscape architects plugged them into plans all over the United States. It's a great tree to have in the landscape because it coexists with lawns very well. Last to leaf out and first to lose its leaves, so it's a bit of a lazy employee in the landscape.
So there are dead branches, and it's weeping sap, a lot of sap. So what's happening here?
This tree has canker and along with some other problems.
So what is canker?
Canker is a bacterial disease, and in a lot of trees it causes a blister, and there'll be some kind of growth under the bark, and when that blister grows, it'll cause the bark to break open, and then the sap oozes out, or it pokes out through little tiny holes, and you can see both of those in the photographs.
Do you suspect that's what's killing the branches as well?
Yeah, the tree's kind of dying a death of a thousand cuts. It has some other issues that were probably brought on by the tree's location and the disease that's there. So locust trees would probably not be growing out in the middle of a hot, sunny prairie. They would probably be growing on the rim of the forest where they have some protection from the wind and the sun from other trees and from their own kind.
So Grant just wants to know what to do.
We're concerned if the damage has been done, you know, internally to the tree, even if we can save it, if we can salvage it by trying to treat it somehow and continuing to take care of it, is it already damaged? You know, is this tree in 5-10 years as it gets larger, is it going to become a risk to, you know, the neighborhood? It's out by the street, so is it going to crack? Are branches going to fall? Things like that.
So when it was planted, a root stimulator was used. It's been fertilized and fed and watered. Can it be saved?
It could be, but it could take one's lifetime for it to recover and to become a fully functioning tree. And this tree appears to be in the front of the home. So all the while you're waiting for this tree to come back, it's kind of the marquee out in front of the house. I think it's unlikely that it would come back, even if someone had a full-time dedicated service stop to come by and check on this tree every month or so. Some of the canker blisters look like about the size of a hand, and the trunk on the tree looks like it's, say, 4 to 5 inches max. So what happens is the area under the bark, the xylem and the phloem, where all the transpiration of nutrients and water is being pumped through the tree, that part of the tree is going to be damaged there. So we have trees like that on campus where the canker has caused a large piece of bark to fall away. So now it's kind of like half the lanes in the highway are shut down. And that's what leads to the dieback of the branches up above.
So generally, you said this tree has been overplanted. Sometimes they're not planted in the right place. They'd like to be with other trees more often. Is this tree generally a good choice or not?
It is, but it's the place that it's planted that's important. So this tree would probably do better in an area that it was in the shade from other trees or from a home for a while. Plus, it likes moist but well-drained soil. So North Normal new construction tells me that it's probably a clay-based soil. Drainage is not superior there. There are trees that are better suited for that and less likely to give you trouble.
So maybe for Grant, he might want to move on.
I suggested that he try a different tree because the spot that this tree in seems to be kind of a central part of the landscape. It lines up with the front door, so it's important that it's a nice tree.
So David Anderson of Bloomington isn't concerned about an existing tree. It's about a future tree. He wants to replace an ornamental pear. And before we get into what he's looking for, let's talk about pear trees because they have issues.
They do have issues, but let's just say they are glorious, okay? If you've ever been to the
beautiful
Kentucky Derby.
When they flower.
Yeah, if you go to the Kentucky Derby at that time of year, boy, Churchill Downs is just skirted with them. They're a fabulous tree if they're away from property. So a agricultural lane, the outer courtyard to the Kentucky Derby where the only thing that's there are well-dressed people and fences, there's not much else there. In that case, it's a great spot for the pear tree, but they're a corky, fast-growing tree that are prone to break right where the branches kind of flare out from the trunk.
David has lost a quarter of this tree four times, so eventually there was nothing left of the tree. He's been thinking hard about a serviceberry tree, but he's not completely settled.
We think that any tree that has these properties will be accepted by the Homeowners Association, and that would be 30 to 40 feet high, 15 to 20 feet wide, with, again, enough of a canopy or whatever you call it, that and with leaves that are large enough and enough leaves that it really does block the sun and it gives us privacy.
They want to block the sun near a window with this tree, but they also can't have a tree that blocks the view to the lake because of the Homeowners Association rules. Is that
right?
Common to run into those kinds of rules in some areas?
It is. Homeowners associations commonly create covenants for the landscape in the residential areas. That is very common.
Go ahead.
30 to 40 feet high is kind of on the shorter side for shade trees. But the good news is there are lots of ornamental trees that reach this size that have a bloom, and they're reliable. So if you like serviceberry, a multi-stemmed kind of bushy-looking tree, you might also want to consider the redbud, the eastern redbud. fantastic umbrella-shaped tree, and in one's lifetime, it'll maybe reach 40 feet. Yellowwood is another smaller-sized shade tree that in one's lifetime, it could reach 30 to 40 feet. You could do the homework on that tree, and depending on where it grows, they can grow taller than that. And I think that the best of intentions are what are in mind when homeowners associations create these covenants. But 30 to 40 feet high in one's lifetime is more along the lines of an ornamental or small shade tree.
And bonus points, if like a serviceberry, it would attract birds. Any ideas? I mean, a crabapple, flowering crabapple might attract birds.
It might, but it wouldn't be my first choice. Flowering crabapples in a newly developed subdivision have some of the same problems that the locust we just talked mm-hmm. about because of the poorly drained soils. Leaf spot, and thing, apple scab, fire blight, those are all issues with most crabapples. I would lean towards something on the native side. The service berry fits that bill. I mentioned the red bud also.
Or you could just hang a feeder in the tree.
Hang a feeder in the tree. But both native trees are a host to many pollinators and many beneficials, and the service berry is an excellent choice.
If you have questions about trees or any problems in your yard, submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, Murph, we'll talk about native trees and squirrels. And I want to know which camp you're in. Love them or hate them when it comes to squirrels, because I don't think there's any in-between ground.
I love the critters. I love all of them, so I'm kind of soft on that.
All right, so that's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. I'm with you on squirrels. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find past editions of Grow and squirrely future ones and subscribe to the podcast at wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Matt Garrison says bandmates in Bloomington Normal cajoled him out of a 7-year music hiatus. Garrison's a longtime English professor at John Logan Community College in Carterville, Illinois. He left music after the birth of his son. His return in late August came with a debut album of a group he dubbed Matt Garrison and the Robert Barons. Producer Micah Hathaway describes the punk-spirited album as Van Morrison meets Johnny Cash. GLT's John Norton caught up with Garrison via Skype from Carbondale to review the songs and stories behind Someone's Gotta Live in This Town.
The 8-song country roots rock album is a testament to the disaffected, forgotten, and left behind. Matt Garrison chronicles workers chewed up and spit out during completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s.
And the Chinese and the Irish are fighting.
He finds the one-time wife of a rich man drunk in a ditch on the side of the road. Drifter on a raft floats down the Mississippi searching for a new life.
M-I-S-S-I-S-S-I-P-P-I.
They're common, everyday, mostly rural people you won't read about in history books.
As a lifelong member of rural communities, those are the stories that really appeal to me.
Matt Garrison grew up in Olney, a town of roughly 9,000 in southeastern Illinois. It's a place he characterized as a once very vibrant Midwestern small town with a farm family community structure. But he began to see his town decay even as a young man, despite the best efforts of those who lived in Olney.
At the same time, I became a construction guy for about a decade of my life between undergrad and grad school. And when I came back to grad school, I knew I wanted to teach at a community college just because I sort of felt like I had, you know, earned my working class bones, and those were my people, and those are the students and the population I really wanted to be close to. And so I guess those are also the stories I want to tell.
Well, I've been everywhere, but I'm back.
The album's title comes from a line in the song, I Belong Here.
Well, I'm gonna stick around, 'cause someone gotta live in this town.
It was written in 2002 after Garrison moved to Carbondale from Fort Collins, Colorado, a town he called a bright, shiny penny.
you know, Carbondale's sort of a tarnished penny. Don't get me wrong, Carbondale's got amazing soul, and I love it deeply. But when we first arrived here, you know, it just seemed like a kind of a slightly run down, more forgotten place than we had been living previously. You know, that's kind of where that lyric came from. I don't mean for the lyric to be specific to Carbondale, Illinois. To me, it's just kind of something that I hope people feel about, you know, a lot of the small towns where they live.
And I belong here.
Though Someone's Gotta Live in This Town is his recording debut, Garrison has been playing music for nearly three decades. He first picked up a bass guitar at age 18, because he wanted to join friends already diving into the local music scene.
You know, I wanted to be part of the fun, and so we started punk bands in Olney, Illinois in the mid to late 80s, when nobody had ever heard of such a thing around there. But we had a real thriving local scene in Olney through the early to mid 90s. It was really something to be a part of.
When you speak up, speak easy.
And he stayed with music until the hiatus 9 years ago. From there, he said his guitar skills deteriorated to the point where he could play but one song on guitar.
That's how out of shape I was and out of touch I was with music.
It was 2 years ago. Friends now in the Robber Barons poked and prodded him back to his guitar. That this album even exists is a testament to the tenacity of those Bloomington Normal musicians he has worked with over the past few years. And you might know them. Drummer Rob Wills, bassist Andrew Moody, and lead guitarist Eric Fisher played together in Tim Callahan's retro garage band, New Kung Fu, which frequently gigged in the Twin Cities 6 to 8 years ago. Keyboard and accordion player Kevin Loesky played in the Irish band Bloomsday in the Aughts. 2 years ago this month, Garrison finally had four or five songs he could play on guitar when those old friends gathered again.
And Moody, the bass player for the Robber Barons, said, let's do something with this. And it just kind of took off from there. And so I went from being kind of totally out of touch with music to having it kind of race back into my life and take, you know, kind of a center focus for me.
The song No Place to Hide from Matt Garrison and the Robber Barons' Someone's Gotta Live in This Town album continues his pragmatic look at small towns, this time from a younger perspective.
Won't you live there long enough, forget about being free. You know it only so well, like a map in a foggy dream. And they swear by the stepdaddy's graves how it has to be. There is no place to hide in Bourne County.
This is a harsh song. This, you know, this implies that one of those small towns you're writing about is, for a lot of people, a prison.
Well, at times for me, as a young person, my own small town became a prison. And I desperately wanted out, and I did get out. And in my 20s, when I was working construction, I moved all around the country. I lived in North Carolina, Wyoming, Oregon, Colorado, before eventually kind of being, you know, drawn back into the Midwest just because it was where my sense of home is. So I don't mean it in any way as a criticism of how people live in small towns. I think instead maybe it's more of a reflection of the way,
sure,
kind of conflict I felt about it at times.
No place to hide.
Surprise, both musically and lyrically, is just one of the delightful aspects of this impressive debut from the 46-year-old Garrison. Just when you think you have a song figured out, a different instrument, chord change, or even vocal cadence emerges. The English professor says those flourishes were unconscious.
Except that as a writer, or as a reader even, I really value surprise. When we're reading fiction, that is sort of the thing that really hooks us and sparks for us, is when a writer surprises us, whether that's with perspective on something or the way something is worded. As far as the music itself, you know, I think of a lot of that is just synergy. It's not just me. It's it's the Robber Barons and, you know, kind of some of the special moments that they brought to this recording.
On the song Not All There, Garrison breaks from observing others to reconstructing four flickers of childhood memories.
The first one, I remember a house.
I remember a house.
Built on stilts.
Built on stilts. Down by the river, there was a girl there. She had hair, color of a cotton mouth. Her eyes set so far apart. You couldn't be sure she wasn't looking away. And her eyes set so far apart. I almost gave my life away.
That whole thing was this memory I have of the first time as a kid that I ever set eyes on the Mississippi River. The next stanza, I remember three generations of women folk telling me, go out in the snow, stay away from the cove.
Stay away from that cove.
It was a real story from when I was 5 years old, and when I walked out the front door of my grandparents' house, and they told me, don't go around the back of the house and go down by the pond, because that dock is real slick with ice, and you'll slip off the dock and fall through the ice. So I went out the front door and went around the back and went down to the dock and slipped off and fell through the ice.
And when I broke through the surface, I could not feel the cold. And when I broke through the surface, the fish moved away so damn slow.
I was rescued by my mom. She pulled me out by my hair, but nobody knows how long I was underwater.
Wow.
Every verse in that song is just random memory, but then the choruses are about how difficult it is as we get older to really be sure all of our memories are exactly what we think they are.
Singer-songwriter and English professor Matt Garrison speaking with GLT's John Norton. And Garrison says the first manuscript novel he ever wrote will be the basis for his next recording project. That's Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal.